Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine. You're listening to a new Delta X podcast with Ellen Hsu. These are conversations with changemakers, innovators, and self-starters who have made their mark on the world at a young age, breaking down the journeys of those who are changing the status quo and building the future today. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
And welcome back to this episode of Delta X Podcast. I'm your host, Ellen Hsu, and today I have a super, super exciting guest. His name is Scott Commoners, and he is the MBA class of 1960 Associate Professor of Business Administration in the Entrepreneurial Management Unit at Harvard Business School, and also a faculty affiliate of the Harvard Department of Economics. He's been conducting research in economics, mathematics, and musicology, as well as teaching, problem-solving, puzzling, among many other interests. I actually got to know him through his conundrums at ISF this year, which were these fun puzzles that we had every single day of the ISF week. And we had to try to solve them to the best of our ability. There's some cryptography, some other mathematical problems. And he also has a weekly column at Bloomberg if you want to go check that out and try your shot at some of these problems. He's also participated in ISF in 2005 and has been judging it for years now, which I thought was really cool. I know last episode we actually had the ISF winner of 2019. So it's really cool to be seeing from the student side perspective and also hear from a judge and alumni as well. So welcome, Scott. It's great to have you here.
Thank you so much. I'm thrilled to be on the podcast.
So I know you did research in high school. Was this where you got like your first exposure to math and economics, or did your interest like develop through like that experience?
Great question. So economics came much later. I actually had no idea that there was such a thing as economics in high school, except in as much as like I had a friend whose dad was an economist. Like I knew you could have the profession economist, but I didn't have a clue what that profession was. And like, I never knew anything about it. Mm-hmm. But math for sure. I had this incredible math teacher, Mrs. Wildstrom, for actually two classes in high school. My sophomore year, she taught a course called Rapid Learner Precalculus. And, you know, in my senior year, she taught us multivariable calculus. I was, side note, I was extremely lucky, right? I went to the type of high school that had a multivariable calculus class, and we had 36 students in it in my senior year. There was like this big math cohort. And Mrs. Wildstrom taught math through discovery. Right? Like you were really supposed to be trying to think ahead of the, you know, of the lesson and like guess where we were going. And she actually gave you prizes if you could like guess ahead of, you know, sort of what we were studying in class or do like, you know, your own independent math projects outside of class. So like you would get stickers or a really, really incredible observation might get you a t-shirt. And I have this like, you know, math t-shirt I got from her, like, cause I had one really good observation once. And so I started to get, like from her, I started to learn that math was something that you could discover. It wasn't just a thing you were going to be presented all the time, but you could be sort of engaged with it yourself. Mm-hmm. And she helped me find my way to this summer research program called the Research Science Institute, where I did my first ever independent math research, supervised by a graduate student at MIT. And that was incredible because it was the first time I had ever discovered something like sort of truly completely new on my own, right? There was this like moment where there was a fact that I knew that nobody else in the world knew at that moment in time. And that was just like incredible. And so I got really excited sort of first about discovery and exploration of math, and then even more about this sort of opportunity to discover and explore beyond where you might otherwise be able to see, right? Sort of beyond the scope of existing knowledge.
What was your project about?
So it was called On Universality Properties of Positive Definite Integral Quadratic Forms.
Wow.
which sounds like a mouthful, but it's really not. So what I studied was the types of things you can express using sums of squares. So there's a very classical theorem due to Lagrange that every positive integer can be written as a sum of four squares of integers. So you can check a few of them, you know, sort of, you know, one can be written as a sum of four squares of integers. So that's, you know, one equals one squared plus zero squared plus zero squared plus zero squared. Okay, that wasn't too hard. Two, you know, one squared plus zero squared plus zero squared. Still not that hard. It starts getting a little harder as you get larger. But in fact, like every positive integer can be written, you know, as a sum of four squares of integers.
Wow.
And you can generalize that. You can actually ask, you know, if I give you sort of a different sum of squares, right? You know, what if I give you like, you know, 3 squares and twice a square, w squared plus x squared plus y squared plus 2z squared, you know, could you write every positive integer? And in that case, it turns out the answer is again, yes. John Conway and William Schneeberger proved an extraordinary theorem that gives a necessary and sufficient condition for being able to write every positive integer as a sum of some set of squares. Mm-hmm. And indeed, this remains my favorite theorem of all time to this day. If I give you one of these like sets of squares, and that's where the positive definite and integral come in. So loosely what this means is that, you know, all of the coefficients are going to be positive and positive integers, and that the cross terms rather are going to have even coefficients. So you might have like x squared plus 2xy plus, you know, 3y squared plus z squared or something. That sum of squares represents every positive integer if and only if it represents the integers 1 through 15. So the only if direction is clear, right? So if it doesn't represent some integer 1 through 15, then like, you know, okay, fine. Then you don't represent every positive integer. But the idea that like just testing a finite list, much less a small finite list, you know, that you could do by hand can get you like representation of 486,000, you know, 321 or something is just totally unreal. So my research project dealt with a similar question where you're writing not integers, but sums of squares as sums of squares.
Interesting.
And so just to give you, that sounds like it should be much harder, but it actually, the difficulty doesn't escalate as quickly as you would think. And just to give like a hint of how that works, right? So it takes 2 squares to write the number 2, right? You know, 1 squared is too small, 2 squared is too big. So to get 2, you need 1 squared plus 1 squared. That takes 2 squares. But to write 2a squared plus 2b squared, so 2 twos in some sense, you still only need 2 squares. It's a plus b quantity squared plus a minus b quantity squared gives you 2a squared plus 2b squared. And so it turns out that like you don't need to start tacking on too many more squares in order to represent your sort of like small other sum, you know, like other sums of squares, so long as there aren't too many variables. And my project sort of showed the uniqueness of a criterion that was sort of like that 15 theorem, but for representation of sums of 2 squares.
I love how you're mentioning all these things that we've learned in school and we've heard about, but like it's applied in such a fun way. And I know you mentioned that you were in high school at that time, right?
Yeah.
Was there any challenges like as a high schooler? How are you able to approach that with your high school mathematical knowledge?
I mean, as I said, I had tons of coaching. You know, I have tons of coaching and I still, you know, math, you understand things in sort of concentric rings, right? Like, I feel like my understanding then was like very surface level. I had just barely enough understanding to make progress on this problem. Mm-hmm. But, you know, lots of people gave me things to read, lots of, and spent hours and hours with me talking through this stuff, right? I would bring tons of questions because I was like totally confused and they would be like, oh, no, here, like you need to think about it this way, or like, here's the idea. And like, and the other thing is that I had worked really hard on this skill of being able to extrapolate beyond what I actually knew, right? Like the lesson of Mrs. Wildstrom's class was basically how to jump, you know, multiple steps ahead in a mathematical argument or discussion, you know, by sort of seeing your way to where you're going. And that's really helpful when you're reading material you totally don't understand. Because like I started that summer program, I had never heard of a quadratic form. Those are those sums of squares, by the way. They're called quadratic forms.
Quadratic forms.
Mm-hmm. I had literally never heard of one, much less like any understanding of like how you work with these things, how you manipulate them, whatever. But what I had worked on was the ability to sort of piece together an understanding from lots of different things that were sort of like out there and guess like what I was looking for to make my understanding more complete. And that means that leads you to ask really good questions, right? You sort of know what you don't understand, but and where you're trying to get in your understanding. You might even say, what's the next delta X?
I love that. Love that. I know that there's so many different directions. Like you can go in math, there's so many unsolved or unproved things out there. If someone was interested in math research, how did they even start? Like, where do they even go to take that first step?
Great. look, the good news is it's much easier than it used to be. The bad news is, like anything, it's, you know, anything in research world, it's actually like also sometimes hard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sort of, I have sort of like a high level view on how to enter into research in any field. Let me say a couple words about that. And then I'll talk about like how you get started in math in particular.
Uh-huh.
If you're interested in research, the first thing to do is figure out what type of research really excites you. Like sort of like what is actually your taste? Like research is really emotional, right? Yeah, even if you're in a bio lab running experiments where you can feel forward progress in a way that you sometimes can't with math, you still like are spending massive amounts of time and energy, mm-hmm. like working on something without knowing if it will ever convert, right? You know, without knowing like, you know, like everything could fall apart. Your hypothesis could be wrong, right? And so you have to be like really deeply excited about the types of questions you're working on or the way in which you're working on them or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way to do that, you know, so the question is like, how do you figure out what you're like deeply excited about? That's actually like a much harder problem than like virtually any research question. What I always recommend for this, when I'm talking to my own students and they're like getting started in research on one dimension or another, is you want to like read super broadly at a reasonably surfacey level for stuff that like gives you like a gut level of excitement, right? You want to sort of like find, and you can do this like, you know, across fields. If you don't know which field you're excited about, you can do it within fields too, right? So like, you know, I spend a lot of time reading recent economics papers just to get a sense of what people are thinking about and see if any of it like really catches me. You know, mm-hmm. I do the same thing with number theory papers, right? Like in college, I did this with like all math papers. I sort of like got these massive stacks. Eventually I concluded like number theory was really my favorite field of pure math. So now I just follow the number theory archive, but like mm-hmm. same thing, right? You just look and it's like, does this feel like it grips me? And if it does, that's when you try and pursue it. So then, okay, you've got something you're excited about. You know that you like quadratic form representation theory. How the heck do you get started? So first thing you got to do is figure out who actually knows some stuff about this, right? You know, and again, you don't have to like totally nail that, but you're looking for, you know, you don't need like necessarily an absolute world expert in quadratic form representation theory, but like, you know, somebody, you need somebody who can at least like help you think about what you should read and what you should think about, you know, and again, that person might become your mentor or they might become your vector towards a mentor. Right? Like, you know, none of these things are like single shot processes most of the time. You know, you look at who's thinking about these questions or who's like nearby and accessible. You reach out and say, hey, I'm super excited about X, right? I love quadratic form representation theory. This theorem you proved, or like, you know, this theorem of like so-and-so is the coolest thing I've ever seen. Love it. You know, I'd love to learn more. Any chance we can chat. In my experience and in my, you know, own approach, when you hear from people who are really excited, even if you yourself aren't the ideal advisor, you try and help them along the path, right? Like, you know, and so you sort of like build a sequence or a chain until you sort of can find your way to somebody who really does actually like know how to help you do what you're most excited about. That's the practice, right? Or the practical, like how do you find a mentor? Like, how do you like sort of, and how do you figure out which mentor you want and then find them, right? There's also the intellectual, like how do you prepare yourself for doing research? You have to get into a mindset where you can be okay with the fact that like your ability to like really connect with the problem is going to ebb and flow. And like some days I get up and my brain is just like, so with it, right? Like, you know, I can, it feels as if you could prove any theorem in the world, or like, you know, you can like, you know, you know, all of your data analysis will be done. Like, you know, just sort of feel like you're so like tuned in. And other days you get up and, you know, it's hard. Like you sort of can't get the math to form.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to become okay with that. And you have to think of it as like a muscle, right? Like, you know, a lot of students I talk with sort of say, but like, oh my gosh, like I can only think about, you know, when they're starting research, they're like, oh my gosh, I can only think hard about this math problem for 5 hours of the day. And I'm like, good gosh, I wish I could do that on a regular basis, right? Like, you know, a lot of your you know, a lot of good thinking comes, you know, sort of right after you felt stuck for a really long time, because like the more stuck you feel, often the better an understanding you formulate. It actually takes a lot of work to understand that you're stuck. So you have to sort of be like intellectually prepared for the fact that it's going to feel like a roller coaster, mm-hmm. and that, you know, staying on the roller coaster is actually completely essential to making progress, right? Like, you know, and letting the roller coaster move, right? Sort of not trying to like completely rebuild it, you know, sort of while it's in motion, but just sort of like following its motion is really important. And that's where that emotion comes in, right? I said, I mentioned you have to like really love and be excited about the problem. You have to like love the thing enough that you just want to keep thinking about it or keep pushing on it or whatever, keep running that experiment, because like some days it'll feel like you've gone nowhere or gone back, you know, 20 steps. The other thing is that like, it's really valuable to cultivate the ability to switch your mode, right? And you don't know it at the beginning. This is practice. Like you get experience, you get intuition for when you want to switch modes. But like some days I think in blue sky terms, right? I stare at a whiteboard and just like try and make my mind go a little bit further into the problem. Other days I go and read like stuff in the literature and try and understand other techniques other people have had or like other ways people approach similar problems. Mm-hmm. And yet other days I just go and think about something totally different, right? It's like, let me put that on the shelf and like do something else. And you sort of, you know, over time develop a bit of an intuition for which input you need when, right? You know, and that's worth like, you know, it's worth sort of at the start, just sort of preparing yourself for the need to switch. And like, you know, you might even like switch, you know, like force yourself on a switch schedule, right? Like if reading literature is getting you nowhere, maybe go think or talk to other people. Like thinking and talking to other people is getting you nowhere. Like go think about something else for 3 days and then come back to it. Like, but so, you know, there's like a lot of mental sort of process engagement build up to think about strategically. And then you just read a lot of stuff too, right? The other way to like prepare yourself for research on anything in particular is to learn a lot about the methods and techniques. You have to think about the mental state of being a researcher sort of as another muscle or part of the process to train as well.
Mm-hmm. I think the idea of having a balance of different things you're working on, you're not always going to be grinding out the project. I think the literature review part, actually, particularly, most people tend to skip that part because it's not fun thing to talk about or even like think about doing.
Your knowledge space and level of expertise is also something that expands, right? And so an abstract that looks intimidating now might look like really intuitive in 6 months. And so it's really important to like not let the fact that the thing looks scary, you know, shoo you away from thinking about the problem, right? If you're like excited enough about it, like you'll figure out how to make sense of the abstract.
Exactly.
I love it. Yeah. That's great.
I love how whenever you recall these stories, I can like feel your excitement too, even just thinking about it years from now and looking back upon your high school project and how excited that made you about math. How did you hear about economics? I know it's something that's not taught at high school a lot. I honestly have very little clue what economics is. So would love to hear about how you got into it. And also maybe you could even tell me and some others who are listening what economics is all about.
Sure. So economics is at its core, in my view, a way of thinking about the world. And it comes from a very, like a small set of very intuitive principles. Like, you know, people maximize, right? They're trying to, you know, maximize something. We call it the utility function, right? They're sort of trying to achieve like their maximum welfare. Mm-hmm. You know, and people respond to incentives. So if you change the environment, you know, sort of someone's in, that changes their behavior because they're maximizing, right? You know, for example, if we tell you that, I'm trying to think of a good example that would have resonated with me in high school, right? If we change the standardized test that like is being used for college admissions, that everyone goes and takes the new standardized test. And if there's a standardized test being used for college admissions, everyone studies really hard for that test. That of course creates strategic gaming incentives, right? Where now and potentially inequality as well, where some people have better access to the tools of studying for the specific test that might distort the impact of the test in terms of actually assessing like someone's ability, right? Like if you know some people have access to like tons of test prep and whatever, they might outperform on the test not because they're you know, better at whatever the test is intended to examine, but rather just because they prepare, you know, they sort of had more resources to prepare. So anyhow, that's people responding to incentives. So economics sort of thinks about the world through this lens of incentives and optimization and so forth, and uses that as a way of sort of conjecturing about and trying to understand human behavior. And then, in especially the type of economics that I do, you actually use that to try and like redesign systems to make the world work better. You know, I work in what's called market design or marketplace design. Mm-hmm. We actually look for places where economic systems are not creating their maximum possible value and try and fix that. You know, sort of try and do things that change the incentives or change the mm-hmm. you know, sort of the structure of transactions or something in a way that makes the world better. So like I, you know, you see this with marketplace businesses. You know, in my, I teach an MBA course where I teach MBAs mm-hmm. about everything from like, how do you build a platform like Uber or Airbnb that's trying to sell a totally new type of service, right? Like, mm-hmm. you know, sort of ride sharing or, you know, renting a room in sort of a, you know, a private hotel like property, but that isn't a hotel. Mm-hmm. All the way to like the system Feeding America uses to allocate food to food banks nationwide, where it turns out they use a marketplace mechanism because they have to figure out which food bank, you know, values a given donation the most. But you want to do this in a way that doesn't involve, you know, sort of food banks bidding cash. First of all, that sounds kind of distasteful, but more than that, you know, if anything, you want to sort of favor the less well-resourced food banks. And so to get a market-like allocation, but without cash, they use an internal currency called shares. Every food bank receives these shares. Mm-hmm. At, you know, in the morning they post like all the new donations, food banks bid these shares, whichever one bids the most for a given donation gets assigned that donation, goes and picks it up and distributes it to their constituency. And then at the end of the day, all the shares that are paid into the system are redistributed back out to all the food banks. And so if you weren't able to buy something today, that raises the chance that you can buy something tomorrow because you banked the shares you had today and you get new ones distributed to you. So your buying power goes up if you're mm-hmm. buying less, you know, locally, if you buy less today. Anyhow, so I teach stuff like that. And these are all just ways of creating, you know, either opportunities for transactions or discovery of value in ways that we wouldn't otherwise have. And anyhow, so that's economics as engineering. How did I discover economics? That's actually a very funny story. So, you know, I had a bunch of friends in college who were really into math, mm-hmm. you know, perhaps unsurprisingly, given how into math I am. And a bunch of them just took in their freshman year this course, Economics 1011, which is nicknamed, you know, microeconomics for math majors. I think its official title is like Advanced Intermediate Microeconomics or something like that. But, you know, really what it was is it's a course that teaches this way of thinking about the world in a very sort of, you know, math modeling based language. You know, sort of Professor Ed Glaser, who teaches it, you know, really sort of instills in you this idea that, you know, you can use economics to think about like literally anything if you sort of, you know, set up the model the right way and you sort of capture the right parts of the dynamics. Anyhow, a bunch of my friends took this in freshman year. They loved it. They were like, Scott, you've got to take this course. And I'm like, I don't really know what economics is. You know, as I said, I had this like, the most I knew was that I had this friend whose dad was an economist. And that was basically all I knew about economics. Mm-hmm. And I was like, but all of my friends love this class, so I've got to take it. And I walked into this class and the first day, you know, Professor Glaser, I guess, you know, Ed, I'm now his colleague, but, you know, when I'm thinking about it in college, he's still Professor Glaser. Mm-hmm. Professor Glaser was, you know, speaking in a language that I felt like I had been thinking in my entire life, right? Like, you know, this whole idea of optimization and responding to incentives, like I remember like trying to explain to people that like the right way to choose which restaurant, if you disagree which restaurant to go to, you should like ask who has the highest willingness to pay for like the right to make the decision. And like all of my like friends thought I was crazy when I said stuff like this, but in fact, you know, that was how I was thinking of. I was trying to describe like utility optimization and like, you know, sort of, you know, almost like an auction mechanism for figuring out where to go to dinner. And suddenly, like, you know, this class was putting terms on these different things that I had like had in my head forever. And that was super cool, right? It was like, you know, getting a language to speak about the way I'd always been thinking. And then on top of that, you know, one thing that's really special, so I took the course, I loved it, right? Like I kept taking courses. Mm-hmm. But then one of the, you know, special things about becoming an economist is that the field, the structure of the field is sort of like a plateau. Like you learn the way of thinking about the world and you learn a lot of like methods and frameworks economists use to think about the world. And then, you know, Glaser's really right. You can think about pretty much anything. And I found that really exciting, right? Because I love thinking about all sorts of different things at once. And so, you know, I just, you know, I got interested in everything and sort of like the interaction between economics and law, you know, ways of using sort of computer science methods to understand like bounds on like our ability to understand economic behavior or to like design marketplaces. And so I got really excited about the field and kept with it in large part because it was giving me a lens I could bring to everything. And I knew I would never be bored.
I was actually recently watching a movie about John Nash and again, the Nash Equilibrium. And I remember there was one part of the movie where his inspiration came from like matching partners or something like that. And how to like optimize how to make everyone happy. And it was just really interesting how can the inspiration can even come from things we encounter so often, but never think about it in that like light. So yeah, I think that's really interesting.
The economic dynamics of matching are totally fascinating in many contexts. I mean, a lot of my research is about that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's sort of astounding, right? The same ideas we use to think about the allocation of, you know, doctors to their medical residencies, right? Like how we, you know, some of the people listening to your podcast, you know, probably like very large fraction, just judging by the interest type, you know, we'll go on to medical school and then go from there to residency. And at least in the United States and in several other countries as well, when you go from medical school to residency, you're assigned to a residency program through a centralized matching mechanism, which actually my PhD advisor was involved in designing. You know, the same type of mechanism is used to assign students to schools in lots of different places, including Boston and New York, all over the UK. And now, you know, I've been in conversations, you know, with a bunch of different stakeholders about, you know, using similar types of thinking to better understand, like, you know, how to the extent that we're doing cross-country vaccine distribution, like how you might do that better and sort of like try and get the, you know, the vaccines to the countries that, you know, sort of the countries that can best distribute the different types as efficiently as possible. And so it's really true, right? Oh, and you know, you mentioned the Nash example. This stuff also like props up when you're thinking about like designing dating platforms, right? Like, and so it's actually, you know, really fascinating to me how broadly you can take these types of ideas, even like in one very specific vertical, like matching theory. Mm-hmm. You know, you can do everything from, you know, trying to improve the assignment of students to schools to trying to figure out like how we can stop the pandemic faster.
I never thought about like the current pandemic and vaccine allocation as an economics problem as well, but that's really interesting. I mean, if it can be applied to so many places, that's what are some other applications that for math and like economics that most people don't think about?
Well, I mentioned the allocation of food to food banks. That's one that like sounds like it shouldn't be an economic application because if anything, you're sort of doing the inverse of economics, right? Like you're trying to, you know, sort of invert a lot of, you know, sort of a lot of inequality and distortion that has been caused by markets. But it turns out that even there, you can use market mechanisms when you describe them, when you sort of design them rather in the correct way. Uh-huh. There's tons of, you know, just riffing off of designing market mechanisms in the right way. There's tons of economics in trying to build sort of sustainable and valuable cryptocurrency systems. You know, I do some thinking about that. Mm-hmm. You know, both with companies and with my students and whatever. There's also, I'm trying to think, like, there's economics in like understanding like how we should fund science, right? Like awarding prizes. right? You think about the distribution of research funding.
Mm-hmm.
In many countries, and including to some degree the US, it disproportionately accrues to the most successful labs, which means that success sort of gets you on this flywheel where you get more and more funding, which promotes further and further success. But that means it can be very hard to enter, right? Like if you're starting out and you've just launched your lab, like how do you get that first funding? And of course, on the other side, if you're the one doing the allocation of the funding, it makes sense that, you know, you should want to give funding to labs that are more likely to succeed. And the ones that have succeeded in the past, that's predictive of future success. And so you can imagine ending up in an equilibrium where like the vast majority of resources go to the groups that have already proven success, and it's really hard to enter. Mm-hmm. But of course, that's like great in a static state, but it's not good for the long run, because you actually want to promote the ability of new groups to like show up and discover, you know, use different methods and discover new things. And so you're constantly facing this tension sort of between, it's almost like in the language of bandit problems, like, you know, sort of it's a probability framework around imagined after a slot machine. I am not condoning playing slot machines. There's what's called an explore-exploit trade-off. Like how much do you sort of exploit the knowledge you have about which groups are good? And likely to produce like interesting, meaningful, valuable, like socially valuable results. And how much do you explore and like look for new groups that otherwise might not have the opportunity to succeed and fund them? That's an economic problem. I have some friends who are really interested in the economic design of video game economies.
Oh, really? Video game?
Right? Like, yeah. Like how do you design the video game so that people want to keep playing it and sort of continue accumulating value and so forth? It's actually very similar to this, question with scientific funding, right? Like how do you make the game fun and something you can progress forward in without like everybody getting to the top level? And so it needs to, you know, and then how do you like decide who should be matched with whom and like, you know, sort of like PvP setting, you know, player versus player settings. And even more, if you have multiple servers, and they all have like, you know, if you have like tokens that you can use to like buy like cooler, cooler armor for your orc or something. I'm making it up. I don't know about it. I mean, there are lots of video games that have orcs in them, but I don't play any of them actively at the moment. Mm-hmm. If you have tokens you can use to buy cooler armor for your orc, you can imagine like that the macroeconomic dynamics of one server might be different from another server. Right? Like if, you know, on one server, everybody really likes the cool armor, and another server, people just don't have the same preference for it, that changes the implied value of the token. And so like, you're actually keeping an economic system in balance, right? You need the token to be like scarce enough that it has value, but not so scarce that people like, you know, sort of can never actually like own or trade them. Mm-hmm. And so there are tons of economic problems like embedded in the design of such a game that like really determine whether it's fun and whether people stay engaged.
Next time I'm playing a video game, I'll be thinking about that. Now that you say it, like all these applications, you're like, oh yeah, there's so many like things that are related to different players and, you know, incentive. But yeah, I've never thought about these things in this way. So it's really cool and eye-opening to start looking at things in terms of an economic standpoint.
I strongly agree. And just as you've said, right? Once you start putting it into the language of economics, you're like, oh, wait, that's always been there. And that's what's really magical about the field. Math is like this too, by the way. Like once you like find your brain finally like connects with a mathematical fact, it's like it has always been there and you just didn't know how to express it.
And I think that's also part of what you mentioned with finding what excites you. Like once you find that thing, like everything gets put into that context. Like personally for my research too, when I'm looking at AI, I start thinking about like the way that I even intake my training data, like when I'm trying to optimize for like fencing, for example, I start thinking like, okay, I have this data set that I'm like pre-trained on and I need to fine tune per opponent. And it's just like amazing how like once you get excited about certain fields, you see it happening everywhere in your life. But I think we have time for one final question. And this is, I think we can talk about something pretty fun and about conundrums, since I know that was how this conversation was even possible in this first place. How did you get started in writing conundrums? And also, what are the behind the scenes, how you actually come up with the conundrum and, you know, design all these really complex problems?
The fun thing about writing puzzles is that it's a form of creative exercise that enables other people to like feel the joy of discovery, like as they like and go from that state where the problem feels impossible to the problem feels like, you know, oh my gosh, the answer's always been right there. Like, and I've always found that very rewarding as a solver. And so it's really, really cool to be able to, you know, give that opportunity and experience to others. And so I've been writing for Bloomberg, you know, mostly doing economics columns and a few math columns. I typically do an end of the year, like interesting numerical facts about the year column. I sort of been writing for them for a long time. And last year, unfortunately precipitated by the pandemic, right? You know, sort of there were, you know, everyone was spending a lot of time stuck at home. My editors sort of said, you know, hey, you do these puzzle things, you know, maybe we could try bringing them to a wider audience. Cause like they knew that I was really into them. Uh-huh. And it was like simultaneously like a life's dream I never knew I had come true and like deeply intimidating, right? Like, you know, I never would have thought that I would get to share my like love of puzzles with other people. Cause it's just sort of like, you know, or like, you know, with the world, right? Like, you know, my friends know about it. Like we swap cool puzzles all the time, but like, you know, the opportunity to like get other people excited about discovery in this form is just like so cool, right? And if you make the puzzle accessible, people can like push their minds further than they often would ever have told you they could if you'd ask them. So how do you write a puzzle? Puzzles for me, at least, start in one of two ways. I either start with a mechanic. I start with sort of an idea of how the solution is going to work. Mm-hmm. And I sort of build a puzzle around that. Or I see something in the world that I think like, oh, wow, that's puzzly. Like that just somehow feels like a puzzle. Uh-huh. And then I don't know what the puzzle is, but I sort of like just massage the idea around in my head until it turns into a puzzle. So like an example of that first one is the escape room, right? So I sort of knew I wanted to write a puzzle that was a vertical escape room, like a column escape room. And I'm not going to reveal the answer because you guys can go online and solve it yourself. But yeah. I had an idea for what the final quote unquote escape was going to be. Like I knew what the solution was. And so then I went and like read up on a bunch of escape room tropes and sort of like thought about like which ones I could translate into a written format and then built this escape room column around those ideas. An example of the latter where like the puzzly thing is in the air and you sort of like eventually figure out like what the puzzle that goes with it is. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've paid any attention to this like non-fungible token crypto thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So when NFTs like first made a big splash, like I guess last spring, mm-hmm. And then the Beeple artwork sold for a ton of money. Audience members, listeners, if you don't know, non-fungible tokens are a type of crypto asset that gives you sort of like an individual, like independent right to something. And, you know, one of the earliest applications was to sell digital art. And there was an auction that sold a piece of digital art in this token way for a very large amount of money. I think it was like tens of millions of dollars. And the interesting thing about them is, you know, it's really just a crypto address. Right? Like it's somehow like the relation to the art is established by society, right? Like we agree that the person who owns this crypto address owns the piece of art. Mm-hmm. And when that was all over the news, like my editor and I started talking about it, and we both sort of had this instinct that this felt like a puzzle somehow, right? It's like, you've got like crypto, it's kind of cryptic, uh-huh. You know, you've got this like sort of new form of art. It's like hidden somewhere or like you need a code to get into it. And that gave rise to what was one of our most successful puzzles, which imagined, you know, sort of that conundrums, our column, had like bought seven cryptic artworks or crypto artworks. We bought the NFTs for seven artworks by like this one artist. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we had the addresses and the reader was supposed to turn these addresses into like information about the art and like figure out what the sort of artwork they combined into was. And so the puzzle was, you know, we had a setup where we explained what NFTs were, we explained the setup, but then we basically just gave them addresses. And the addresses were like collections of numbers and letters, just like a, you know, like a blockchain address. They weren't actual blockchain addresses. So like no one was like trying to send us cryptocurrency or whatever. but they looked kind of like blockchain addresses. And you stare at that thing and you're like, what the heck are these? Like, how does this have anything to do with art? Much less like, how do I start decoding it?
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like, you know, it's funny. I hadn't thought about this in you know, this similarity before, but this one I've watched a bunch of my students solve. I use it often for like teaching people how to solve puzzles. And the way they process through it is actually very similar to what I was describing with like sitting in that library at MIT, like trying to understand that last step in the quadratic forms proof. Like, you stare at these addresses. There's actually very little information in the puzzle. It's just the addresses, essentially, and then a little bit of information about like what you're supposed to do once you start cracking them.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, this thing has got to tell me the location of some art or something. And you're staring at it, and you're staring at it, and like suddenly, and I've watched like four or five different groups of people, mostly my students, solve this as teams. Suddenly, like some piece of it just like resolves, right? Like you immediately, like, you know, you go from like, I have no idea, this is all nonsense, to like, oh no, wait a minute, I think I know what the first step is. And once you do that, like you solve the first step, it unravels in the next one, and like, and you gradually find your way to, you know, locating the art. Again, I'm not going to reveal the full solution because
yeah,
you know,
I'll have to try
listeners it. might want to try and solve it. Mm-hmm. But what's really amazing about it is the thing can look like one sort of type of address,
mm-hmm.
but it turns out to be a very different one. There's your hint. The other interesting thing I mentioned, I was talking in research, right? You need like, you know, at least for me, like, you know, having tons and tons of people to talk to. Oh, sorry. I forgot one very important piece of research advice.
Mm-hmm.
It's always valuable to have a friend to talk to about it, right? Like mentors are great. Like, you know, advisors, like all of these people are essential or, you know, at least were for me, for my own development.
Mm-hmm.
But like, perhaps the single most important input is some friend you can just like tell about it and like, you know, rant when you're frustrated or like, you know, even better if they can give you ideas, like, you know, that's great, but they don't even have to be able to give you ideas. When I'm like really stuck on a research problem, I call like one of my college friends, often one who knows nothing about the field, and just like tell them about it. And like talking it through with them, I usually come up with new ideas. Anyhow, sorry. So I mentioned that there's this whole cadre of people who like support you on these, on research. This puzzle went through six incarnations. This like art, you know, art NFT puzzle went through uh-huh. six incarnations that were terrible. Like I had so much trouble figuring out how to actually make it accessible and mm-hmm. like make it really like feel like something you could enter into. And, you know, my editor, one of my friends from this puzzle team I'm on, like, you know, lots of people went over it and like helped me think and workshop the idea and like get it into a shape that like, you know, it starts, you know, it has this property where it starts totally abstruse, but you don't give up. And so again, right, like you don't do these things alone, right? You know, even the people who look like they're doing everything themselves, and like, you know, there are, right, like, you know, I interact with them, like they will tell you that they're not doing any of this stuff alone, right? There's like all these people who like support them and inspire them and give them ideas and stuff, or help them understand, or just even, you know, are just there for you when you're frustrated. And so, you know, whether it's, you know, sort of, so when you're stuck on a puzzle, you should like call a friend and see if they'll solve it with you. When you're stuck writing a puzzle, you call a friend and talk it through. And when you're, you know, stuck on a research problem or, you know, anything else, right? It's really essential that you shouldn't think of it as something you have to overcome alone.
The parallels between like conundrums and research too, it's like you crack the small problems and then you slowly reveal that there's like a bigger picture. And it just feels so great when you finally crack the case. I think that's what really makes conundrums so, so fun. And also, yeah, just like the people around you too. I think that's really valuable. I always talk to my sister. She hears me rant about my project a lot.
Excellent.
So yeah.
That's really great. I call my brother all the time too. He's heard so many rants about math and economics. And incidentally, you know, this could be a project for you and your sister too. you know, after one of these rants, my brother and I ended up writing a joint paper.
Really? That's so funny. Well, I think we're approaching the end of the podcast, but it was a lot of fun being able to talk and hear about, you know, your research and math and economics too. I learned a lot about economics. I never thought I'd be, you know, looking at restaurants like differently to today when my mom asked me for dinner. Maybe I'll pull out the, you know, who has the highest willingness to pay card. But yeah, I really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you so much, Scott, for coming on.
Thank you so much. Look, this was so much fun. And I love what you're doing with this show, right? Like, for me, being able to reach the next generation of, you know, scholars and future puzzle solvers is just, you know, the most exciting and most important thing. And so I'm very honored to have this opportunity through Delta X.
Oh, thank you so much. Make sure to check out the show notes. I'll link below the Commoner Conundrums page in case you're interested. And also the newsletter if you want to subscribe and get these podcasts every 2 weeks. But yeah, thank you so much. And we'll see you guys in the next one.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Delta X Podcast with Ellen Hsu. If you learned something new and this podcast made you think, then share ITSPmagazine.com with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.